This is VOA News via remote. I'm Tommy McNeil. Former U.S. Vice President Joe Biden is accepting the Democratic presidential nomination this Thursday night at a moment that marks the climax of his party's unorthodox 2020 National Convention. It also marks the pinnacle of a political career that has spanned almost half a century. The former vice president, who at 77 years old will be the oldest president ever elected, will be feted by family and former rivals as he becomes a Democrat's official standard bearer for the campaign against U.S. President Donald Trump in November. He is expected to focus on uniting the deeply divided nation as Americans grapple with the months-long health crisis, related economic devastation, and a national awakening on racial justice. Republicans kick off their convention next week, where President Trump will officially receive his party's nomination. More than 792,000 people have now died globally from COVID-19. More than 174,000 of those deaths are in the United States. Brazil has the second highest number at more than 112,000. Mexico third at more than 59,000. The number of worldwide infections is approximately 22.6 million, with the U.S., Brazil, and India together making up well over half of that. Authorities in Peru and Morocco have approved phase 3 clinical trials for a potential COVID-19 vaccine developed by China National Biotech Group. Phase 3 trials, which usually involve several thousand participants, allow researchers to gather data on the efficacy of potential vaccines for final regulatory approvals. The experimental vaccine of CNBG, a unit of state-owned pharmaceutical giant China National Pharmaceutical Group, has entered a phase 3 trial in the United Arab Emirates. This is VOA News. The Trump administration has formally notified the United Nations of its demand for all U.N. sanctions on Iran to be restored, citing significant Iranian violations of the 2015 nuclear deal. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo delivered the notification to the president of the U.N. Security Council Thursday, setting the stage for a showdown in the world body that could lead to a crisis of credibility for its important and powerful institution. Pompeo said the United States will not allow Iran to acquire nuclear weapons.
President Trump and this administration have discarded the fiction that the regime merely seeks a peaceful nuclear program. We will never allow the Islamic Republic of Iran to have a nuclear weapon.
None of the other council members believe the U.S. has the legal right to demand the reimposition of sanctions because President Donald Trump withdrew from the nuclear deal in 2018. And Pompeo said that the United States was disappointed that other Security Council members did not back the United States.
All told me privately that they don't want the arms embargo lifted either. And yet today, in the end, they provided no alternatives, no options.
As such, the demand is expected to further isolate the U.S. at the U.N. and test the Security Council's credibility. New York City police officers have faced more than 320,000 complaints from the public since the mid-1980s, but less than 3% resulted in penalties. That's according to newly released data that offers a rare glimpse into the long-veiled realm of police misconduct and accountability. The New York chapter of the American Civil Liberties Union Thursday published data on complaints against more than 81,000 current or former NYPD officers after prevailing in a fight with public safety unions that had sought to keep the record secret. The sentencing phase of a suspected white supremacist who pled guilty to killing 51 Muslim worshippers in New Zealand's worst mass shooting will begin on Monday. The March 15, 2019 attack carried out by a lone gunman took place across two mosques in the city of Christchurch and was targeted at Muslims attending Friday prayers. The Australian Brenton Tarrant was armed with semi-automatic weapons and broadcast the attack live on social media platform Facebook, which the company said did removed after being alerted by police. Tarrant admitted to 51 charges of murder, 40 charges of attempted murder, and one charge of committing a terrorist act in a hastily called Christchurch High Court hearing earlier this year. The court will now sentence Tarrant on all 92 charges. Via remote, I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
We'll be right back. morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, August 21st. And here are some of the stories we are covering. Mali's protest movement says it is willing to give the military junta a chance.
The junta people have given some assurances that elections will be organized in 2021, in 9 months. This gives an assurance that they're not here to remain in power.
Jihadists carry out mass abductions in northeast Nigeria. 45 people are dead in the deadliest shipwreck to date off the Libyan coast. Zimbabwe was to summon the Vatican representative over Catholic bishops' criticism of the government. And health officials urge African government for children to return to school.
The decision to open schools or not amid the pandemic is a difficult one. But we must find the right balance to avoid trading one adversity for another.
And a call for rapid testing in Central Africa's most COVID-19 infected country. Those stories plus Samson O'Malley Sports are coming up on Daybreak Africa. A leading member of the M5RFP opposition coalition in Mali says citizens are looking forward to a yet-to-be-established transitional government which will organize fresh elections next year. Yasamake says if the military junta fails to keep its promise to organize elections within 9 months, the people will resume their protests to demand accountability, just as they did to topple President Ibrahim Boubacar Keita. His remarks follow a meeting between leaders of the military junta and a second of the opposition coalition on Wednesday. Yasamake tells viewers Peter Klote that the military junta will have the support of the people if its leaders keep to their promise to peacefully hand over power.
The junta people have given some assurances that elections will be organized in 2021, in 9 months. That this gives an assurance that they're not here to remain in power, and they're going to also organize the transition in such a way that there will be only 6 members of a military among the 24 members that they're planning to have the transition team. And then we'll be forming a unity government. We are beginning to understand that they are working with the people and they're working with opposition and all the political, because I have been clear that power does not belong to the military. They should be under political authority, and they are not suited in democracy to rule. So as long as that is the perspective and the vision that they will take, they will have the accompaniment of the people of Mali for sure.
Some people are saying that the military coup is a violation of the very constitution that Malians embraced.
Absolutely. We have expressed our condemnation. This is an unprescribable crime in Mali, according to our constitution. But the international community, including France, if you've heard the statement from Emmanuel Macron, that we cannot dwell on the condemnation. We have to move on to how do we move forward? How do we take this country forward? That is today the main concerns of the Mali people, including the political authorities.
So what are the aspirations of the people of Mali, for which the opposition said they represent, going forward following this coup?
Our aspiration is that we are never going to go back to business as usual, where leaders are not accountable to the people. And that's the reason why there has been protests in Mali throughout the country to combat ill governance. So I think that this is a turning point from corruption, from ill governance to a more efficient leadership. That's what the people of Mali aspire for. And that is what we will be requiring of our leadership. It's never going to be business as usual in Mali again. So this is a turning point.
Yeah, what do you say to regional leaders in ECOWAS and the African Union? These two organizations have a zero tolerance for military coup. As an opposition leader in Mali, what is your take on the condemnation and the suspicion that perhaps even the junta might not even organize the election within the period they promised to?
The junta is going to be kept into contempt the same way we have kept the outing president in contempt. We are not going to sit. The people of Mali are going to remain mobilized and vigilant and making sure that the power belongs to the people and that power is for the well-being and the welfare of the people of Mali. So that is our intent.
Yasamake is a leading member of Mali's opposition M5RFP coalition. You're speaking with VOA's Peter Clotty from the capital, Bamako. Extremists linked to the Islamic State have abducted hundreds of people in a northeast Nigerian town. Local military said the armed group came with more than 20 trucks on Tuesday evening to take away the hostages. Security experts say the abduction signifies an attempt by extremists to reestablish their strongholds in the region after years of military campaigns. Timothy Obiezu reports from Abuja.
The northeastern town of Kukawa, where the attack took place Tuesday evening, lies in Borno State close to the shores of Lake Chad. Local militia say Islamic State fighters dressed in military uniforms battled soldiers guarding the town before taking hundreds of hostages. One of the militia fighters, speaking on condition of anonymity, said the soldiers suffered losses. He says what has happened is very disheartening. I hear people saying the soldiers killed were 10 in number, he says. But honestly, they are more than 10, and their military vehicles and motorcycles were also taken. Most of the people kidnapped had recently returned after fleeing Kukawa during a bloody attack by Boko Haram fighters in 2018. For 2 years, Nigerian authorities have been encouraging displaced people in the northeast to return to their homes following military operations that degraded the strength of jihadist groups. But security expert Lawrence Alobi in Abuja says the effort to resettle internally displaced persons came too soon.
The two things were granted, because knowing fully well that this place had been a place, an area where the terrorists or the bandits had control, and these people who had been resettled were attacked, that's why they were moved to IDP camps. From the security point of view, like I said, you have to think ahead and plan. Yeah, you have to anticipate crisis to manage crisis. They need to anticipate that, okay, supposing they come back, what happens?
The current location of the Kukawa hostages is unknown, and the kidnappers have not made any demand. Authorities have deployed fighter jets on a search and rescue operation. Security expert Ebenezer Oyetakin says the attack is likely a statement by the jihadist group.
All of this abduction is just to spite the government to say, yes, we can still do something. But definitely from the fact that they were holding more than 19 local governments under them before, and today they are not holding even a ward under their control, but running, doing hit and runs, shows and demonstrating that our security has performed better than the past, but there are so much yet to be done.
A decade of jihadist violence in the northeast has killed some 30,000 people, displaced more than 3 million, and plunged the region into a humanitarian crisis. Last Monday, President Muhammadu Buhari met with security chiefs and governors in the northeast and assured security will be restored in the region. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja.
International aid organizations say 45 people were killed, including 5 children, in the largest shipwreck of the Libyan coast this year. The survivors, mostly from West Africa, are now being detained in Libya after attempting to cross the sea into Europe. Heather Murdoch reports from Istanbul, Turkey.
Survivors said the ship's engine exploded off the coast of Libya, drowning more than half of the people on the crowded boat, according to the United Nations Refugee Agency, the UNHCR. The victims were mostly from Senegal, Mali, Chad, and Ghana, and they are among more than 300 people who have died this year trying to get to Europe from Libya by sea. Officials say that estimate is probably very low. This is Tarek Argaz from the UNHCR in Libya.
Local fishermen were the ones that spotted the boat and rescued the 37 survivors. These survivors were the ones that gave us the details on the date of departure and the number of people that unfortunately lost their lives.
Europe no longer sends rescue ships to sea to search for people attempting to cross in small, often barely floating boats, leaving the Libyan Coast Guard as the only hope for victims of shipwrecks. The travelers on these boats are almost always people who have fled violence or extreme poverty and are trying to get to Europe to apply for refugee status. When boats wreck and the people are rescued by Libyan authorities, they're usually then brought to detention centers, where they often suffer human rights abuses and are endangered by the ongoing war in that country. The UNHCR and the International Organization for Migration say 7,000 people have been returned to Libya this year, and 17,000 have made it to Italy or Malta. Heather Murdoch, VOA News, Istanbul.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, August 21st. President Emmerson Mnangagwa's government says it is summoning the Vatican diplomatic representative to Zimbabwe to explain what it calls insults directed at the president by local Catholic bishops. The bishops last week issued a statement condemning the deteriorating human rights situation in Zimbabwe. Columbus Mavunga reports from Harare on the growing conflict between the church and the state.
Late Wednesday, Zimbabwe's Justice Minister Ziyambi Ziyambi said President Emmerson Mnangagwa was concerned about the statement which Catholic bishops released last week. In the statement, the Zimbabwe Catholic Bishops' Conference raised concerns over what it called the deteriorating human rights situation in Zimbabwe. The clergymen called on the government to address the concerns instead of denying them. Ziyambi said the statement was an insult to President Emmerson Mnangagwa.
Given that the venerable bishops represent the Catholic Church, government is compelled to directly engage the Vatican in order to ascertain whether or not such statements reflect the official attitude of the Holy See towards Zimbabwe's leadership, or whether these are merely the views of the various individuals concerned. Notwithstanding the deliberate, provocative, and divisive nature of the pastoral letter, the president's commitment to the path of engagement with all religious communities remains steadfast and solid.
On Thursday, a group of former Catholic priests in Zimbabwe urged the government to soften its position towards the church and instead attend to issues the Catholic bishops raised in their statement. One of them is Abel Makahamadze, who is now a pastoral caregiver with a private company in Harare.
Our government right now is operating from a position of fear, by and large. And because of that, there is lack of trust of anyone who is within their circles. I think what needs to happen now is to come to a point where we agree and acknowledge what is on the ground, the reality on the ground, is that there is a crisis in the country. We may also agree to disagree on the origin of that crisis, but the starting point should be to agree that there is a crisis.
On Wednesday, Ziyambi dismissed the claims that there was a crisis in Zimbabwe. However, a hashtag Zimbabwean Lives Matter has trended strongly on social media since the beginning of the month. That follows a number of pro-democracy activists going into hiding, saying they fear being arrested for organizing an anti-government protest last month, which security forces thwarted. Journalist Hopo Chingono and opposition leader Jacob Ngaruvume have been in prison for a month on charges of stoking violence ahead of the July 31st March Against Poverty and Corruption. Columbus Mavunga for VOA News, Harare.
Experts from the World Health Organization and the United Nations Children's Emergency Fund say it is critical that children across Africa return to school soon and safely. To that end, the UN agencies have formulated guidelines to make school openings safer on the continent. Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg.
Across the African continent, hundreds of millions of children have been shut out of school as governments have imposed coronavirus restrictions by closing educational institutions. But top global health officials say that after nearly 6 months of disruption, it's time to get back to school. A recent survey by the World Health Organization found that schools are fully open in only 6 of 39 countries surveyed. About a dozen countries, including South Africa, plan to resume in-person learning in September. Dr. Matsidiso Moeti, WHO's Regional Director for Africa, says the decision to reopen schools is not an easy one for health experts, administrators, or parents, but it's the right one.
The decision to open schools or not amid the pandemic is a difficult one. But we must find the right balance to avoid trading one adversity for another. The longer that children are out of school, the greater the risk that they may not return to school. School closures are potentially exacerbating risks of teenage pregnancies, of violence against children, of substance abuse, of anxiety, loneliness, and isolation.
Mohamed Fall, UNICEF's regional director for Eastern and Southern Africa, says the risk of children falling behind socially or academically is worth considering. He also expressed concern that in his region, UNICEF found that the incidence of violence against children has risen, while nutrition rates have fallen, with more than 10 million children missing school meals. He also notes that the science supports schools reopening.
So far, science and data, as mentioned by Dr. Moiti, have shown that children are not the biggest bearer of the disease. We have seen in many countries that the age group from 5 to 18, who are the age group for primary and secondary school, are just 2.5% of the confirmed case of COVID across the country we are working in. And then making it clear that if there was a carrier of the disease or a risk of spreading transmission, the highest risk is not in this age group.
That said, both experts urge schools to follow precautions, especially to avoid the spread of the disease from children to vulnerable people. Those precautions have been laid out by the WHO, Moeti said. But she and Fall acknowledge that cash-strapped, overburdened schools may struggle to implement some guidelines. According to research by WHO and UNICEF, only a quarter of schools in sub-Saharan Africa have basic hygiene services. Just 44% have safe drinking water, and only 47% have basic sanitation services. But Moeti said it comes down to taking the necessary precautions.
I think what needs to be, from the safety point of view, it is keeping a distance. It is the children not transmitting the virus to each other through the wearing of masks, and it is very much paying attention to hygiene, water and soap, and sanitizers if that is necessary.
Moeti and Fall, who are both themselves parents, say they understand that getting small children to keep a distance, to properly wear masks, to adequately and regularly wash their hands, and to otherwise observe proper hygiene protocols is no small task. In many ways, they say this school year will be, for teachers, parents, and the kids themselves, a learning experience like no other. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
Cameroon is currently the most COVID-19 infected country in Central Africa, with nearly 17,000 confirmed cases. Yap Boum is a representative from Epicenter, the Epidemiology Research Center for Doctors Without Borders in Yaoundé. He spoke with Ricky Stryak about why rapid tests should be added to more reliable tests.
It's not a decision between one or the other. The decision that we are taking in Cameroon is how can we actually use both? Because it's important to highlight that Cameroon is one of those rare countries where we have 15 labs which can run PCR in a 10 region of the country, 9 out of 10. However, we've also realized that quite a large number of our patients or suspected cases were at different levels of our pyramid. Some in a region, some in a district, which make it very difficult for them to get the result within 24 hours. Because if you really want to track the virus and to limit the transmission, you should be in a position to act within a very limited time, which we assign ourselves as 24 hours. And we were not able to deliver that. We were not able to actually give back the result for all within 24 hours. That's actually one of the major reasons why we decided to move toward the rapid test. The question was, okay, now we will move into those rapid tests. Are they performant? Are they safe? Are they actually going to meet our demand?
Are there any systems that are being put in place in response to the current COVID-19 pandemic that, in your opinion, will be useful and sustainable in the long term toward other pandemics or other even endemic diseases that might come about again in the region?
Yes, definitely. And to be honest, not because I'm in Cameroon, but in that particular space, Cameroon has been an example of implementing what we call incident management system at the different level to decentralize. All the region, they have their own management system. And that management system, which has been put in place and set up for the COVID-19 will now be used for other disease. Currently, for example, as I'm talking to you, we have a measles outbreak, we have a cholera outbreak. Now we put in place a system where we can coordinate how we respond to those outbreaks. And I would say COVID has been an accelerator.
What will be the unique challenges in securing access to a vaccine in Cameroon, to all of Cameroon, if and when one is developed?
I think the main challenge will be the availability and how to prioritize. Who do you give the vaccine to? Are you giving the vaccine to the healthcare workers? Are you going to give the vaccine to the at-risk population, those with the age population, those with comorbidities? I think for me, that will actually be the key. Who are we going to prioritize those vaccines when will be available? Because we all know we won't have 6 billion doses of the vaccine the first day. So we definitely need to have the plan and to put those priority in place.
That was Yap Boom, a representative from Epicenter, the Epidemiology Research Center for Doctors Without Borders. He was speaking to Ricky Stryak from Yaoundé. Now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Friday morning to you, Samson.
Good Friday morning to you too, James. We begin the sports with the announcement by the Confederation of African Football of new dates for the 2020 AFCON qualifiers as well as the 2022 Qatar World Cup qualifiers. CAF in a statement said the Nations Cup qualifiers will resume on the 9th to the 7th of November and is scheduled to be completed in March next year. The group stage of the World Cup qualifiers will start on the 31st of May next year, with the final playoff round scheduled to take place in November 2021. Head of Football World Governing Body Gianni Infantino has been cleared of corruption allegations by the football regulator's Independent Ethics Committee, but he remains under investigation by Swiss authorities over the meeting between the FIFA chief and the Swiss Attorney General Michael Laborde. Nigerian Football Federation President Amaju Pinnick has weighed into the matter, declaring support for Gianni Infantino.
We are unrepentant in support of Gianni. Gianni went and appointed a black African, a Senegalese, a lady, to be General Secretary of FIFA. So please, with all due respect, Blatter, you served your time. Platini, you served your time. Allow this young man. Everybody is happy with him.
Away from football now, world 5,000 meters record holder Joshua Cheptegei and three other Ugandan athletes have gone into mandatory self-isolation as a precautionary measure. Joshua Cheptegei, during the Diamond League last Friday in Monaco, broke the 5,000 meters record previously held by Ethiopian track legend Kenenisa Bekele. He went on to set a new world record in the event, which he ran in 12 minutes 35.36 seconds in the 5,000 meters. Cheptegei, who will now self-isolate in his home village of Chepchabai, says there is nothing to worry about.
I want to call upon every Ugandan to remain calm, because I believe that we can follow the guidelines given by the Ministry of Health, and as protocols are observed, of course we are going to quarantine for 14 days. I know it's not going to be easy, but of course we shall pray that God gives us the grace that we may complete successfully without any symptoms.
In the meantime, Kenyan long-distance runner and marathon world record holder Eliud Kipchoge has predicted more record-breaking success for Ugandan athlete following his impressive performance in Monaco.
Joshua is in good shape. It will actually dominate for the next year, even over 5 years or even to 10 years. 5,000, he has broken the world record for 5,000. I think 10,000 will follow. You know, he's capable of actually smashing all the records. And in future, I'm expecting him to come and actually run under 2 hours in marathon.
And that's it on Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a very good weekend. And that's it for this Friday, August 21st edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing you a very good weekend.
VOA's Our Voices television program is about more than just sitting and talking about women's issues. It's about listening to them and bringing their opinions to the table and making sure that their voices are heard. Because our lived experiences, our stories, and our voices will help shape the next generation.
Check your local TV listings and join the conversation each week with our voices on VOA.